Hello and welcome to another Challenger Cities podcast with me, Ian Montgomery. And I think this one's really timely because Canada's in election mode in just under a week. We'll know what's going on. But I got Tom Goldsmith, who is perhaps one of the best people right now in Canada writing about the subject of policy. And I think policy is one of the sort of poor cousins, really, of strategy that often gets a bit overlooked, underloved, and is one of those things that is frankly really, really important. Tom mostly does this from the perspective of innovation and government, more leaning towards higher orders of government than municipal, but I think policy is a really, really important topic to get into if we want to talk about how do we change and improve and create bigger, better and stronger Challenger cities. So we'll just get into it. We'll talk about how we define policy, where policy is good, where policy is lacking, and some of the things that we can do to drive better policy making in our cities. So, without further ado, here's a conversation with Tom Goldsmith all about policy. So, Tom, thank you for agreeing to something that I provoked you into, because you are probably the best writer in Toronto at the moment on the subject of policy.
I would not go that far, but thank you.
I'm allowed to say that. Like, if you say it, it's boasting, but if I can say it, it's cool. Whether people believe me or not is a totally different thing. I genuinely believe that, though, because policy is normally a very, very boring and very dry topic when it absolutely shouldn't be. And I kind of want to spend this conversation slightly sort of demystifying policy and get into like what constitutes good policy and then how policy can turn into bigger and better things. And then hopefully we'll wrap it up and talk about cities in some way, shape or form.
That's good.
But to get started on that, Tom, this is a chance for you to practice and polish your introduction to Tom Goldsmith.
Well, thanks for having me. So, yeah, I'm not a policy person at all by background, I guess is the place to start, which I think is hopefully one of my strengths when thinking about policy.
So, I think so.
My background is originally I did a PhD in diplomatic history, so early 19th century British foreign policy. So I guess some policy angle, but yeah, very far removed from a lot of what I think about and write about and work on right now. But I got to the end of that and I kind of wanted to do something with a bit more impact and relevance that wasn't just studying long dead old rich white men, which very much is what diplomatic history was and is. So wanted to kind of try and get into the policy world, and I have ended up now kind of doing lots of kind of innovation policy and the intersection between innovation, technology, and economic and societal outcomes. And it's been a bit of a zigzag to get there, but I've kind of worked in the UK for policy organisations like Technology Association, for the Business Association for the Tech Sector, for the Royal Society, the UK's National Academy of Sciences, done stuff for local regional board of trade here in Canada, done stuff for think tanks, and I now run my own policy consultancy working with clients in the UK and Canada on different policy, innovation, technology issues and how we actually kind of add them up into hopefully a better economy and society.
See, I think you did that really well. I think that was a pretty good introduction.
Okay.
I'm also enjoying that I'm amassing people. I'm just basically collecting the people who are Brits / Canadians.
There's a lot of us.
There are a lot. And I like people that have kind of got those sort of seen this bit of the world and then they're in another bit of the world and you sort of think and talk about things in a bit different way.
Oh, yes.
Can we get into policy? So,
yeah,
I'm pretty sure as soon as I say the word, people are like, oh God, and they shouldn't. But like, what is policy to you? What is good policy?
So first, what policy is, and then what good policy is, because a lot of policy isn't good policy. But I think policy is broadly what government does or doesn't do on any given issue or problem. And pretty much all policy is like about addressing one kind of problem or another. If everything's going well, there's no need for public policy. So public policy comes in at the point where there is some kind of issue that needs addressing, whether that's accelerating economic growth or moving people around or fixing education. A lot of it is in the space of like public goods where there's no incentive for private actors to do anything like education, like innovation policy, R&D, where the gains to society are much larger than the gains to any one individual. So no individual's necessarily going to act on that. So policy comes in trying to solve those problems. A lot of the time, it doesn't try to solve those problems. And the inaction and like doing nothing is a choice. And very much that is part of the policy picture. I guess when it comes to like what is good policy, it kind of like sits at the intersection between evidence, politics, and money. And good policy is something that is politically doable. Like it doesn't matter if the evidence points in a certain direction. If you're unable to build the coalition of people to actually get it done, it doesn't matter. It's not policy. It's not getting not really getting done. It needs to be affordable. So much we could do that we just can't afford to do. So that again doesn't sit in the realm of the feasible or the good. And then yeah, the evidence. Like there's a lot of policy that is not necessarily evidence driven, and we can get into that. But also there's a lot of evidence that is contradictory. So that's where the politics comes in as well of do you place the emphasis on what do you really want to see? What evidence do you prioritize? There's yeah. Good policy kind of sits there and hopefully leads to a better society, better economy, more prosperity, all of that kind of piece.
I like how you sort of take the different forces of it, because you'll see things where the money exists but the evidence doesn't. Actually, I think when you do a lot of innovation work, the evidence actually is kind of broadly irrelevant when you start. Because the really interesting stuff is you can't pre-rationalize it. You then have to have the evidence once you've done something. But a lot of the time, and this is a cynic in me, but you'll see that policy, which is like, we found some spurious evidence. And it's admittedly because we don't really know enough, but that'll do the job. And then it's not evidence-backed. Once it's been actioned, it's almost like the evidence is like people are like, oh yeah, it's rather inconvenient now someone has to tell us that our policy worked or not.
There's definitely a big element of that, and I think that's a problem that Canada suffers for in particular, of like the okay, how are you evaluating this? Are you actually tracking the right outcomes? Are you being guided by that? What is the theory of change? I think Alex Usher from the Higher Education Strategy Associates like calls it Canada's like underpants gnomes problem from the South Park episode of like collect underpants ... profit. Stage two is the ... and a lot of he kind of says like a lot of Canadian policy, innovation policies, like throw money at a problem ... have great innovation outcomes. Yeah, really what that evidence is, what that theory changes, how, what levers are you pulling and in what way, how are you implementing that is lost in the fog.
You touched on a thing about in that sort of saying policy is primary government, and I think like often this is maybe a really naive way of putting it, but like policy feels like a replacement word for strategy in the public sector. And whereas like I spent most of my career in the private sector, and they will love to talk about strategy. You can argue about whether something is strategic until the cows come home, but like strategy is always something that's been talked about. But like, they won't talk about policy. Like policy tends to be some sort of thing that it sits in the HR or the procurement realm, not in the sort of at the executive table. And I'm really interested in like that. Often when you're talking about policy, is policy just strategy?
Yes, I think in part. I guess it's a blurry line there between the two ideas, but also just the difference between like what a given business has in its scope versus what a government has in its scope kind of thing. And just the range of responsibilities, the range of kind of needs and conflicting priorities that a government has are far more than what a business faces. So for a business, there's a clear kind of end point to strategy. It is about shareholder value ultimately. And for better or worse, there's a whole argument around like the need to think about stakeholder value, the like triple bottom line kind of B corporations and that, and how far. Yeah, there's a whole side tracked out there. But there's a greater clarity for a business, and there's a lot that business can ignore. Like, are there roads that enable you to get your product to market? Are there trained staff that you can hire? And if you fire someone, you could find a replacement. They don't have to actively think about that. Whereas for government, the provision of roads, the provision of education, the like immigration policies, taxation policies, that there's so much more there, and they can often be in massive conflict with each other,
mm-hmm.
which is a kind of key piece. It is much harder to be strategic as a government because there are so many threads and like stakeholders and other kind of issues pulling on you. So I think there's overlap between the concepts, but I think this is very much something that's often missed, and a lot of the DOGE stuff in the US and the idea that you need to bring in entrepreneurs to reform what government is and what it does, and kind of like you need a business-like mindset of government, really understates the complexity. It doesn't mean there's nothing government can learn things from business. That there's for sure areas it can learn, but they're very different beasts.
I think that you touched I often use this sort of phrase, if you design for the fringe or the edge, you get the middle for free.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And really great corporate strategy tends to be where are the places where nobody else is looking, where we're going to go and do something somebody else hasn't thought about. And often those things can be quite different ends of an extreme. And you'll end up going and creating a great, loved, lucratively successful business out of it. But in doing so, you'll have blind spots and things you've ignored, because if you try to do everything, you end up with nothing. Government ends up in that place where it's often you can cover the vast majority of bases, but then miss a couple of things and you'll be crucified by a disproportionate amount of the electorate. The media will go after you, even if they're not the ones being impacted by it. And I feel like that's why policy is really, really hard, because you kind of need to be strategic with that and be all things to all people, and those things are very, very difficult.
Definitely. And I think there's plenty of examples of good policies that have failed or been rolled back, or you've been forced into U-turns because the harms are very pointed. Mm-hmm. So you have a very mobilized group opposing the harms of a policy, but the good is very diffuse, so you aren't able to mobilize a coalition in favor of it. Tying it to cities, it's some of the kind of NIMBY problem, yeah, of the cost to a neighborhood building new housing could be felt quite keenly, but the benefits are to future residents who don't even exist yet. They're not in the city because they don't have somewhere to live. So you can't mobilize those potential residents in the same way. It's a very simple thing, but you see things like the capital gains tax that's been a big hot button issue since it was proposed in last year's budget, which would have changed the inclusion rate for capital gains here in Canada. And it would have raised a fair few kind of billion for government revenue. It would have, I think, kind of broadly kind of made a more equitable taxation system, in that different types of income from labor, income from capital, income from dividends are treated more similarly, so it doesn't create perverse incentives. So the policy rationale is pretty solid, but it impacts certain groups particularly. So that kind of pushback that you get is very real.
The NIMBY thing's interesting. So staying in an Airbnb in Madrid last week, and the host was very clear of there will be noise. Yeah, it's apartment in a city, I'm not expecting it to be quiet. He's saying that he's seen that I was from Canada, and he said I get a lot of Americans and Canadians, and they leave bad feedback about the noise. And it's but it's a ground floor apartment in Spain's capital city, about 20 minutes walk from all the good stuff. I'm not expecting peace and solitude here.
Mm-hmm.
And we end up having a little bit of a chat about that. But it's the thing of, we want the perfect solution, but then we want all the benefits, but none of the drawbacks. And I think that that's a really interesting thing of, how do you sell policy change in the thing of, if you take NIMBY as a meter, we'd all like slightly lower, we'd like more affordable homes, even if we like the value of our house going up and up. We'd all like more things on our doorstep. But then we also want peace and solitude, and it doesn't quite map. But when people push, when the sort of YIMBY movement pushes for things, they don't necessarily do a brilliant job of, okay, you are going to get a bit upset by the noise, but how can I do something that's going to play and help you in your favor? I think about this in like sort of the, if you think in the context of like congestion charging, everyone like wants to complain about congestion charging if they drive. And to be honest, fair point, because you're charging them for a thing they've always been able to do. No one then goes, in return for you having a congestion charge, we're going to give you the same amount of transit credits. And I think that's a side of policy that's sort of interesting of like, how do you then square the circle almost?
Yeah, I think that's very true. It's I think some of this really is the, it's something I've kind of written a bit about in the past, but like the role of narrative, the role of storytelling as part of the policy process. And this is like, yeah, evidence can take you so far, but there's a role for telling these stories to like, what is the future? What is the direction you're kind of heading in? What is the kind of like imagining different futures? And are you able to like really communicate that to different people at different levels and really kind of connect the dots for them? It's such an important piece of it. But I think it's sometimes.
Well, also, governments are shit storytellers. We can just be kind of honest about that.
Yeah, I think it's true. Yeah. And there's many reasons for that, but it's not a strong point.
Yeah. So when you're sort of, when you're trying to develop good policy, we haven't really gone into like what really good policy is, but how do you create good policy? Is there a sort of magic to like a process of it? Is it sort of, is it down to some of the storytelling? Like, how do you make sure that you don't go through this sort of process and end up with a bit of a dog's dinner for, to be all things for people?
So preface everything I say of like, I've never been worked in government, so I've never been on the like sharp end of doing this. So I get to like opine from outside. It's hard. Good policy. Well, I guess like, there's so many different ways to think about what good policy is to begin with. And I guess like starting from the lens of just like ideological approach almost to policy, like what are you actually trying to come out with in the end? What, where are you placing the kind of emphasis? Where are you placing the value? Because that's such a huge guider of what good policy actually is. And I think for me in my work in working organizations and in my kind of writing and everything, like I place a kind of high value on like what I kind of like describe of like wanting to see a more inclusive and innovative Canada. And that means an economy and society that more people have the chance to participate as innovators, more people have the chance to benefit from innovations themselves, and the wider societal and economic risks and benefits from innovation are more equitably shared. So that's a broad vision of like where I think innovation policy and the various like intersections of like competition policy, technology policy, regulation intersect.
Mm-hmm.
If you were starting from a different viewpoint, which say it's like economic growth at all costs is the priority, and that if you believe trickle down economics or something along those lines, what I think is good policy is going to be very different to what that person thinks is good policy. There's overlap there, like around like entrepreneurship and other things, but there's some fundamental kind of like differences. I guess in that way, like good policy in part comes from that political vision setting, the like ideological drive of government, whether that is municipally all the way through to federally, and like what is the ideology, what is the approach, is there a cohesive vision of where you kind of want to get to that's able to bring together what can be disparate conflicting policies. So there's a big macro picture. Sometimes good policy depends on just, is the window open for it? So there's been various like academic kind of work on kind of like policy setting, policy kind of agendas, and some of it is like you need a certain confluence of events to actually create space for something that goes beyond iterative into something that's bold. Most of the time, policymaking is fairly iterative. It is small things. There isn't much bandwidth politically or in terms of finances to do anything bold. So it's like tinkering around the edges kind of thing, which is in reality what most policy is going to be. There's never a world where everything can be bold because for various reasons it's impossible. But if you do want to do something bigger, then that window has to be open. For me, I think we're in a time of where it is fairly open, like between what's happening in the United States, between what's happening globally with climate change, with kind of various other trends. There's some kind of like big trends that have changed the status quo quite substantially from what we've seen over the past 30 years. So how can you use that opportunity to do something different, to think in different ways? But that's true in some areas. In other areas, like if we're entering a recession, the money's going to be less, the ability to think boldly is less. So there's a lot of pressures, a lot of kind of like conflicting kind of things that how that feeds into, is there a chance to do good policy?
I don't know if that
answered your question.
But it does answer the question. I think like it makes a lot of the time to go and do the small, like your in reality, whether you're in doing strategy for a private corporation, whether you're doing policy for a think tank or policy for a government, there's always going to be constraints around it. But to do the things that maybe don't take a huge amount of resources, or maybe like the window is not necessarily particularly open, you still have to have done the bigger thinking to then be able to take advantage of, here's the small things we can do right now. So in a lot of like my innovation work, I'm always like, what's the biggest possible thing that we could imagine or think of, and then what's the smallest possible thing we can do right now that nudges in that direction? And I think when it comes to sort of in the politics of it, as you mentioned, like what's the thing we can get away with at the moment? And that might be the thing we can get away with in terms of our opposition. There might be things we can get away with our electorate, maybe things we can get away with like the media environment. But you kind of always have to be doing the big thing to be able to do the little thing, right?
And I think like that kind of like the fact that you need these ideas or need that kind of like thinking to be happening for government to be able to like take it and run with it in part. And this is where I think like if we are in a moment where big change is possible, then there's a real need for very rapid, deep thinking about what does that mean? What can that look like? What do alternative visions, alternative kind of futures, alternative directions for policy making? What are they? And how do you mobilize coalitions outside of government who are able to communicate that, to piece together different parts of it, to be able to like put pressure on government to do that? Because a lot of issues and topics, policymakers aren't going to independently be pushing these things outside of the hot button kind of like policy areas. A lot comes down to the like, in the innovation space, both innovative companies, but intermediary organizations, third party funders, other kind of bodies, to be able to like craft that agenda and piece it together, be able to kind of communicate that to government players, to government stakeholders.
How do you tell the story of good policy? Because again, I think you end up in this place where a lot of people talk about a policy document and they'll be like, oh, that's a long, dry, comprehensive thing, but like, it's not to say it's bad that you actually need those so that people can be like, have somebody done the thinking and the research here, but then how do you then tell the story of good policy effectively?
I guess it like, is that, do you mean in terms of like an individual like policy or change versus a wider policy area, wider policy agenda for an entire government? Because they're different for each.
Tell me more, because I don't know if I knew when I asked you the question. Keep going.
So I guess like if it's like let's take like AI policy as an example. So like an individual policy could be the previous Liberal government announced $300 million dollars towards AI technology adoption, so gave like $200 million to regional economic development agencies to do programming to support technology adoption. So there's communicating, I guess, like that's an individual policy, individual lever that's been pulled, like get more funds to innovators to adopt AI. So there's like that, but that's nested in within a wider AI agenda that's led by ICED, but around their kind of like pan-Canadian AI strategy. AI adoption's a thread of it, but there's also AI compute and lots of stuff on there. There's support for talented researchers. That's itself within a wider, like more broader government approach to AI, where there's like government's own adoption of AI. there's AI regulation and what they attempted with ADA that was under the same innovation department, but not quite part of the AI strategy itself and was sometimes at odds. So Mr. Champagne wrote to the House committee that was dealing with AI regulation saying about like how AI is spreading rapidly and we have to act now because there will be irreversible harms if we don't regulate this area. That regulation died on the order paper. They got nowhere. But even still, the same department and the same minister was announcing, yeah, 300 million for AI adoption, saying we need to rapidly catalyze Canada's adoption of AI. At the same time, the same minister is saying there's going to be irreversible harms if we don't act to regulate this.
It's yeah. Like,
those are conflicting policies, but they're within the same department in the same AI. There's their government's approach, and then there's like more broadly the government's approach to the economy and to society, and actually what is AI going to do to our economy, to do
also,
to workers.
What do we even mean by AI? Is it just a bucket of things?
Very much. But like, so the it goes from individual policy up into areas, some like explicitly part of the same bucket, to overlapping ones, AI and competition policy, AI and various others. So like, communicating it, telling the stories, telling the narratives of it. And this is one, like, I think that a lot of policymaking is relatively incoherent. It is very siloed between teams, between departments, between different policy domains. And that's somewhat inevitable in large, complex bureaucracies where you need to have teams working on certain things. It's not completely inevitable, and you can do far better at drawing those together so they're not actually actively contradictory, like a lot of the time it actually is. But yeah.
it's sort of interesting. Like, I keep pulling back to draw the parallels in like the private sector, but like, if you're in a big bank or technology company, retail or whatnot, and you'll have like the different silos of the company, nowhere near as complicated as federal or provincial or even municipal government. There's always like a handful of people who are sort of like not quite fixers, not quite troubleshooters, but you know, rather irritatingly, Matt is the one that knows all these people across the place. And like, we really need to draw Matt into this conversation. Matt's in about seven other conversations. Game time with calendar's really hard, but like, there's always these sort of, and the reason I use Matt is there's one guy from one client that I always think of, and it's just like, how the hell does he know everything that's going on in this organization? We can sort of weasel around pots of money and stuff. It's very, very effective. If you don't have that person, or you don't have the system, that's very hard to do. And like, I think the same thing is true in government. There's, especially at like a federal level, there's always like seven or eight characters that are sort of like pulling the dots together, even if it's not necessarily documented. And if it was up to them to craft a policy, they couldn't do it. But like, they know how to pull the people together who can. I think like, you see almost in the context of cities, like having spoken to a lot of cities, you'll see people who are like, oh, I know the one or two people that are pulling everything that you're doing together and making the incoherent coherent. And then when it doesn't exist, I don't know how this works, or if it's just sort of by accident, by personality. But I find that sort of side of things, like the way you've articulated it, is like a lot of policy is incoherent. Actually, like, yes, but if you then need to have the systems and the people and that can sort of navigate the mess and pull it all together effectively.
Very much. And this is something I'm kind of very interested in, like the organizational piece. There's, I think, like a wider like state capacity piece.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Are governments as institutions and bureaucracies well equipped to deal with these interlinking kind of issues and complex like polycrisis kind of environment that we're in? So there's a kind of piece of state capacity, and there's a piece of how individual players and actors are able to navigate the system, and are they well trained and well equipped to kind of do that? Can you run a good meeting is something that is so...
And a different thing, what's the definition of a good meeting? Because as a consultant, you are trained, the definition of a good meeting is you covered your agenda, and actually no real debate, conversation, disruption, distraction came about as a result of your meeting. Whereas actually a lot of the time it's, we've got really valuable people together today, and actually we do want to see some sort of dissenting voice in the room to get the value from the meeting. Otherwise we may as well have just had an email.
Yep.
I actually think that's that you've hit, as soon as you said like state capacity there, you hit on something, and then like that meeting point really triggered me. Sorry to throw you off, but like, I think it's like, it's so interesting how hollowed out it's become to the point where like cities or governments, they don't have the institutional experience, understanding and knowledge to do a thing, and they've outsourced it to the consultants who run a good meeting. But the good meeting actually means that like the next phase of work was signed off rather than the outcome was necessarily achieved.
It's such a huge, like, something that's been a conscious agenda to dismantle the capacity of the state by certain groups and political parties and others who have wanted to privatize those functions. And we've seen a kind of, yeah, pro-market neoliberal agenda that has really been unpicking the capacity of the state since the late 1980s, mid-1990s. And that's responsible for a lot of the different crises and issues we face now, but government isn't necessarily well equipped to kind of pick that up. Like, see this very clearly in housing in Canada, and the kind of the role the federal government used to play in this area, the capacity it had to build housing and build affordable housing at scale that was then privatized, cut off, the funding cuts were there, and that capacity has not been rebuilt in the same way or to the same extent, even though the kind of scale of the crisis we face is so deep and so huge. So there's the policy making kind of piece, and that ideation and like the thinking that the big con thing for Mariana Mazzucato and the outsourcing to consultants and all of that side. But there's also that implementation, that doing, the shovels to the ground aspect of government, which has also been hollowed out. And we need a more at least in my view, I think that we clearly need a more interventionist government. We need different types of government institutions. Like, if we look at like competition policy or kind of areas there, and how an intangible, innovation heavy driven economy is so much different for competition than your bricks and mortar kind of factories or stores, and how you need different approaches to understand the impacts of like mergers on the ability for firms to conduct innovation, to conduct R&D, and to have the next generation of disruptors who are going to creative destruction side of things replace the incumbents. Our institutions aren't equipped to do that. Our laws and institutions from the people there, the bureaucracy that's there, but the laws and the frameworks that govern them aren't equipped to deal with that. The situation has changed so kind of dramatically that you need to kind of rebuild that capacity.
It's interesting that you look at, and I think that going through this current election cycle in Canada, like, I've seen it in the UK as well, but you have the bloat of the state, and there's more and more bodies inside the government. But like, you want to go and get something done, and everything seems to take longer and longer. And I think that then leads to the really angry side on the other side of the political spectrum that are like, we need less and less government. And sometimes it's like hard to argue with them, because you're like, well, what are all these tens or hundreds of thousand people in the public sector doing? I generally don't know, but I think it becomes that that's the really sort of tricky spot that we found ourselves in now, because a lot of the time, like the public sector side, maybe we're like straying into politics less so than policy here, but the job has been to sort of manage the status quo more than it has been to get to where we want to get to. And I think that's the thing that people find it hard to articulate, but that's where good policy should see us through to better outcomes. But it's very noisy and very difficult to have that conversation right now.
It very much is. And you kind of see all this playing out in the United States, obviously, with Elon Musk in government in particular, and the idea of like taking a sledgehammer to it. And it's rooted in part in a legitimate frustration of government being unable to do the things that it needs to do well. There's definitely a kind of like strand of folks in the US, like Jennifer Palka and kind of others, who have been working in the US Judicial Service and really trying to change how government does things and to really disrupt some of the status quo there, where government has been a slow moving bureaucracy that like just has been focused on like internal processes rather than external kind of outcomes. Mm-hmm. And there's various reasons for that and other things that have kind of led to that. Has led to a position where like you have one part of the spectrum is like dismantle the state, is clearly unable to it, and you have another side of the spectrum that's kind of been boxed into a corner of defending a status quo that doesn't really work. Like, yeah, that's clearly not like, I think you could approach it from a lens of like, no, dismantling the state is terrible, but the status quo isn't working. This is some of the like the candor is broken rhetoric that the Conservatives were using at least prior to Trump and the current election cycle, but like in many ways for many people candor has been broken. Yeah. And just defending it of like, no, candor is great, isn't actually a good response. Helpful. To no, it's not helpful. The status quo works for some people and some groups. It does not work for everybody, but anywhere close to a reasonable kind of like sense of imagination and everything. So how do you reform things without breaking them? And this is where everything in the US is, there's a dismantling of certain oversight and certain like attorneys general who are investigating Musk and his various companies and other kind of pieces. There's a ideological driven agenda, like aid is bad and all of that kind of thing. Like I really bristle against kind of where people point to that. We're like, we need a Canadian version of that, or we need to take some of that and do it a bit better. But it's like, no, what they're doing is like functionally an administrative coup of the state and dismantling of state oversight. Like, there is a fascist element to what's happening. Mm-hmm. There, do not take that. But there is a separate, distinct, legitimate kind of way to approach government reform, thinking about how you need to disrupt the status quo and think about it different and understand that you can't just go in and break things in the way that's happening there. That going back to like what government is and like how it differs from companies when they think about strategy and policy or innovation and otherwise, government is the backstop. People's lives depend on government doing its functions. Their health depends on government being able to deliver the goods and services mm-hmm. they need to deliver, whether that's making sure employment insurance checks get into accounts, or whether that's access to healthcare, whether that's refuse collection and things like that. If you break government, it's not just a dip in your share price or like some issues that need fixing. It's people's lives on the line there. So you need to approach it with the gravity of what that is.
Yeah.
But it doesn't like lessen the fact that, yeah, you can do better, you should do better.
I think this is really interesting thing of like there's a fear of being wrong. And policy is one of those things. I think even like the word policy makes people very scared of making a mistake. And then if you translate this into cities, I think a really good example is like the drinking in parks thing in Toronto, where like there's hundreds of cities around the world where like you can go and have a beer or a bottle of wine with some friends and the like social order will not break down. And admittedly, like not like Anglosphere's countries do have a problematic relationship with alcohol. But at the same time, it's like one of these things of like our policy needs to be to go and experiment with this in certain parks and then get a report and then make a decision and go from there. And it's not a bad, and I'm picking a trivial example, but it's not like a bad way of doing it. But it's the resources that you spend on that you're then not doing something perhaps like sort of bigger and more meaningful.
Yeah.
And I think that's there's like an interesting side of it where the status quo defense of government is like not bad actors. I'm going through a thing at the moment where like I need a spec from the city to do with the building of the house that I'd bought. And you go in, you hand in a paper form, you wait 10 weeks, and after 10 weeks you'll email and go, hey, I never heard back. And like, oh yeah, we never did that. We'll do it now. And then you reply with the same information you've already provided, and then you get a response going, oh, I don't work Friday afternoons and Mondays. And I can see it's like you can all the sort of conservative right-wing rage sort of bubbles up inside of you and whatnot. They're not a bad person, they just have a job, but like their job has been designed in a manner that is now probably should be obsolete, but they're not obsolete as a person. And I see all this sort of vulnerable set of human resources that could and should be doing bigger and more important and better things. Like the way that you fix that isn't by saying we're going to eliminate all your jobs and then we'll figure it out later. The way is like going, how do we make this thing better and unleash you onto bigger and better things? And then there's a thing over there in policy, which is like, maybe this is me picking on policies, so totally challenge me on it, but it's like the there's that middle ground you have to go and find, and you'll make a load of mistakes, and it's okay.
There's definitely kind of a few things there. That willingness to experiment and make mistakes is so important, but so constrained, and that is like ultimately down to the politics of it. You don't want to do something risky that might fail, that might then be a stick to hit you with come election time or down the line. So there's a reluctance to take those kind of risks, and this very much plays out with innovation and the reality that most ideas, most innovations are going to fail or going to have bumps on the road and all of that. There was the big, I forget the exact name, in the US, the big solar power kind of farm company that got like $500 million or even more in kind of US funds that then went bankrupt, and that was a big thing that the Obama administration kind of got attacked with for supporting this kind of like failed enterprises. The same scheme supported Tesla and was kind of really crucial in enabling Tesla to come up with his innovations. But the successes get pinned to genius entrepreneurs kind of thing, where failures get pinned on government. So there is that reluctance there. And some, again, like that balance between the politics, the money and the evidence, so much evidence like talks about the value of like portfolio approaches to innovation and being able to have a high risk tolerance to support different kind of things. But in practice, that's hard to do. DARPA and the kind of ARPA programs in the US do it, but the US is huge and the military is a buyer of those innovations. Like outside of DARPA, the model hasn't been quite as successful. There's had been successes, but it's not been as successful because there's a high risk tolerance in the military for those kind of innovations and staying at the cutting edge kind of thing. The UK is trying it with ARIA under Sir Matt Clifford, the chair of that. I think that's his name.
So
the UK.
Say Sir Max Clifford.
Sir Matt Clifford.
Oh, but he's Max Clifford. Wasn't he the sort of PR guy?
No. Oh, God. Oh, yeah. No.
It's like, really? That's a strange career change.
I think Sir Matt Clifford. I'm
that makes more sense.
That. But he also chaired the UK's kind of AI opportunities initiative white paper that they published this year. That kind of political element of risk taking is a big piece, but I think there's a few elements there of not only is the like avoidance of risk a bad thing in and of itself for like be able to do pilots or do initiatives and accept that, but then it feeds into a lack of accountability, an avoidance of accountability, and this goes back to that the underpants known kind of problem of governments. Don't want to explain the dot 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 because they might be held accountable to it. So you kind of minimize that like exposure to risks or to attacks and don't put the thinking down on paper. They don't necessarily need to develop thinking to the same extent, and announcing money is a good thing, but you don't report on the outcomes. And one example of this is the $4 billion digital adoption program that was a pandemic era initiative but then shuttered a couple of years later, very quietly, with no explanations kind of why or what the lessons learned were. So like part of that risk taking is that you're able to take the lessons and learn them and apply them, but the culture of secrecy, the avoidance of accountability, means that's not the case. So you get stuff on there. There's a great piece by Noah Zon in Policy Options kind of looking at that program and how it was quietly shut down, but like literally the week before it was shut down, there was like people in Parliament citing it as an example to be copied in other policies. It's like how bad policy could then perpetuate itself because you have that kind of like risk aversion.
There's a psychological safety kind of needed, right? So like in business, it's accepted that things won't work, albeit I'd say business culture is becoming increasingly more like the public sector, where it's becoming more and more small-c conservative. But like there has to be a sort of psychological safety of the things that we tried that didn't work, but at the end of the day, like, it wasn't by us being bad actors, it was by us trying something. And then the portfolio thing of these three other things did work in some way, shape, or form. It's sort of interesting you need a bit more ability to feel psychologically safe so that you can have a positive legacy, because otherwise you end up in a place where you don't necessarily have a legacy, you just have a perpetuation of what wasn't already working or could, or maybe was working, but just could have been better.
Yeah,
I think that's actually the more common thing. Like, none of these things are necessarily completely broken. It's like, to 7 out of 10, it kind of works, but it could be better.
Yeah, and I think that's like the risk right now is for past decade, 7 out of 10 being okay is fine.
That was world class.
Yeah, but the compounding kind of like lost performance, I guess is what way to put it. Like, right now, that's not really sufficient for the moment.
Yeah. Was the thing of like, how did you go bankrupt? It's like, well, gradually, yeah. Then suddenly that's the institutional erosion that's effectively happening, right?
Completely. Yeah, no, that's the best way to think of it.
So I want to sort of like, as we come towards the end of this, I talk to you about this all day, and I'm going to see you next week. So.
Yes.
Like, in the context of cities, I think it's sort of particularly interesting because it's when things have been done at the federal level, they're far enough away that we have a big figurehead to blame. So in the UK context, it's a prime minister or it's a minister, and we can't name anybody else after that. Broadly in Canada, it's a prime minister because nobody knows who else exists in government. we can name a mayor, we can name our mayor, we can name our premier, and we can name our prime minister, but that's about as much as we can do. But I think cities is really interesting because it's often quite tangible and really local things that are, they really, like, often we don't notice them until they really matter. The Birmingham bin strike is probably a great example of this at the moment, of like, no one thinks about the rubbish until suddenly there's like, it's all piling up in the streets and it's like a sort of dystopian disaster. But you see more people start to go like, hang on, I can actually influence the thing that's on my street or in my backyard around policy. Because I think there's something really interesting there where, like, policies, dare I say it, getting slightly sexy, but the thing that's getting slightly sexy is the thing that you can immediately influence, not necessarily the guff that you see on social media that turns into an argument.
Yeah. So I think, like, cities are so important, and so, like, that connection between the kind of, like, immediacy there at the city level, I think is such an important piece. Like, coming from, like, my perspective of the innovation side, it's also one that is really like under considered and underappreciated, and I don't think we do place-based policy making well.
Amen.
Yeah. This is what, like, yeah, the cities as the delivery of, like, yeah, your bin service and that kind of thing, but there's also cities as their role within the province, within the country, within that kind of like bigger perspective of the differences between cities, the local barriers, the local opportunities, the need to have that bottom-up involvement and participation, but also contribute that into a bigger picture. It's an area I'm like heartily fascinated in, and I think it's so important. I'm working on one report at the moment that will look at like unlocking Canada's place-based innovation economy, that working with a collaborator, kind of diving into some of the data there to really understand the differences between different cities and communities across Canada and where that potential kind of is. We don't do it well. We don't engage cities at the right times, parts of the process, and we don't adequately support them and the people within them to like really thrive. Probably is like an inclusive kind of sense of like what thriving is, what prosperity for a city and a community is. And yeah, I think that's big, what we need to do better.
There's an interesting thing that I've noticed in Canada, which is like, in Toronto, there's a very large vocal community that likes to say, this isn't very good. But there's not a particularly equal force that is, here's what we could do that would be better. Or the phrase that I'm really enjoying at the moment, more interestingly, less wrong. I can't remember where I heard that, but it was brilliant. Because it's all like, I think it's actually something you need in policy and public sector, which is like, I've not got the perfect solution, but this will at least get us. The context I think I heard it in was like vaping. Like, lots of people are anti-vaping. But there's an argument to say that, like, actually vaping is more interestingly less wrong than smoking. Although there might be some evidence to say maybe it's more interestingly more wrong than smoking. I don't know. But I think there's something quite interesting along those like kind of lines. You go to like Alberta, and Albertans are really, really noisy, especially right now, and especially if they have a right political leaning. But they're very sort of solution oriented. They're very much like, how might we do this thing in a different or better way? Where would we go and look to that could do it better or differently? They're also very quick to go all out and never work in Alberta, but forget that. But I think there's something interesting around a different type. Like, everyone likes to sort of play Canadians as this sort of homogenistic blob. But actually, and then, like, I would argue that The Maritime is a very resourceful book, overly polite in a sense of, oh, that's not my place to intervene. Like, so I'll let so-and-so handle that job. And meanwhile, be quite resourceful and sort of hack together a solution that works for them. All of those sort of, you need all of those viewpoints, but you need to unleash them in a productive manner. And that's the thing that doesn't necessarily exist. Or at least it's the thing that I've not seen in any one particular Canadian city, let alone as a nation. And if you can make that work, there's something quite special there, because Canadians have, they're in that place where I think there's still a net positive amount of goodwill, whereas Brits are all like, oh, if Britain's shit, there's no point. Bring on Nigel Farage. It's like, oh, God. Anyway.
There's a whole conversation there on, yeah, the UK and, my God, the scale of problems and issues and all the rest. But yeah, when it comes to Canada, I think that is the big challenge of, like, how do you add up everything, all the places, all the people, all the different kind of parts of Canada to more than some of its parts. How do you take local strengths and mitigate local weaknesses and combine them with other parts of the economy, other parts of the country? How do you unleash the kind of potential of these places to be able to thrive locally, but also thrive globally as part of a wider global value chain, global networks, global collaborations? How do you really kind of, like, add that all up together? And I don't think we're there yet at the moment doing that. I think part of my diagnosis, we, like, default to, like, federal solutions, or we need a national strategy for X, or we need a federal strategy for Y, when in reality, this is to your point of, like, most people don't necessarily know the politicians or the people locally or who their councillor is or otherwise, but, like, the constitutional system in Canada, the diffusion of powers is intense. Canada is, like, among, if not the most decentralized country in the OECD. And is, I believe, the country with the highest level of subnational spending in the OECD. So national policies and a single national strategy won't work for Canada in that way. The provinces are far too powerful, yet don't play a big enough role, and cities have a key part to play, but aren't necessarily empowered or funded adequately to play the role they could or should be kind of playing. So how do you really kind of, like, shift that approach is a kind of, like, big question, and I think a kind of big imperative.
I like to end these things on the magic wand question, which is, like, don't let the sort of reality or the things that we perceive to be, like, true inhibitors. And if you had a magic wand to make, to wish or to command onto the world or onto cities, what would it be? And I feel like it's particularly good timing, having had the answer to where you were coming to before.
I think to have more people, more policymakers, but more people in general, realize the complexity and the interconnection across so many things. The world is incredibly complex, but incredibly interconnected. So much policymaking, but so much of how people live their day-to-day lives is so siloed.
Mm-hmm.
Shutting their eyes to what's happening in the world or what's happening in other parts. And there's a selfishness, if I could be as bold to call it that, that kind of permeates that. That means that the outcomes we want, we don't see. And there's a need to, I think, or I wish we could see those kind of connections and see how atrocities in other countries might play out in the types of policies we see here, or to see how what happens south of the border influences here, to understand that. And to your point, like, to accept mistakes in the policy making of these are complicated things, but we need to try harder to achieve those better outcomes. So
I think that's a nice magic wand one to end on, because I think this is maybe me being delusionally too hopeful, but I think you're starting to see people make these connections now of, oh, if I do this, then that might happen, or the thing that's causing me pain right now is as a result of that. And while I couldn't influence it, I might have been one of many people who enabled it. And then the most trivial manner of this, I think, is like when people go to the grocery store now and they're like, my wife did this lunchtime. Well, I went to the grocery store and there was some very cheap, very delicious looking strawberries. And there was definitely a sort of question in her mind of, oh, they're American, I can't buy them. And I think that's so fascinating of, like, that all those behaviors kind of add up. And I think there's a little bit of like Canadian nationalistic pride of don't fuck with us. But at the same time, like that points to some of what you've just articulated, like starting to percolate through into people going, but what can I do? And that's got to be a good thing, right?
I think so. I hope so. I'm potentially cynical on some of it, but
come on, I'm meant to be the cynic, Tom.
I'm like a massive cynic. No, I'm reasonably hopeful, I guess, but
maybe that's why I like your writing.
I think this is where it gets to that like complexity piece of whether it comes to like online harms and technology regulation. If there's a moment of drawing together and appreciating that, you're running up against a social media ecosystem or media and social media ecosystems that prioritize disconnection, that create siloing, that really facilitate mis and disinformation, and that facilitate huge individual and societal harms all the way up to genocide. And you're dealing as well with rapid advances in AI, which is perpetuating some of the same. So you're kind of like, again, in the moment we're in, like, we're dealing with the kind of implications of these policies, the potential implication of these technologies. We need to think of it holistically. We need to understand those impacts, those systems, how they kind of play out, the levers that need to be pulled to kind of address some of them. But what does that mean in terms of Canadian sovereignty or like the just societal flourishing, the inclusion of different kind of people, the kind of mitigating of kind of harms? It's, yeah, hopefully we're up for that moment. But
I'll end on this, but there's, if you get on a subway train almost in any city at the moment, I was in Barcelona the other day, I was in Madrid before that, on the subway in Montreal and stuff like that. If you watch the people, and it only works in places that actually have proper internet signal on the subway, so Toronto's a bit of a, doesn't quite work there yet, but you watch the people, like the vast majority of people will be staring at their phones, to your point of sort of like social media addiction and online harms, things like that. And then you'll see people who are not, and the ones who tend not to be, the people who might be your granny, because your mum's on Facebook. But you see this huge, like not huge, but more significant number of younger people. And when I say younger, I'm talking like probably 16 to 20-ish. And a lot of them are like, less of them are on their phones. And it's almost like they're conscious of, we've grown up in this environment. And you obviously don't see them reading newspapers and whatnot. I actually don't really understand where they're getting their information from, unless it's just coming from a close. It's not necessarily healthier, but you're seeing the shift in behavior. And I don't, while the rest of the world that's in sort of positions of power is still talking a lot about social media, I wonder what's happening with that generation below that we don't necessarily understand well enough yet. Like it's, and I'm going to be the hopeful one rather than the cynical one, but like I'm hopeful that we're seeing a generation grow up now that is thinking about those connected bits of the tissue. Or if not, they've just hacked it all off completely and just living in their bubble. Who knows?
And I think this is one where it's complex. It's both. Like, great. I think there's an element of that. But also, in a moment where mental health for Gen Alpha, Gen Z is unprecedented lows, where like teen suicide rates are unprecedented kind of levels and everything. So I think that it's, you're seeing a response to a generation or two generations growing up online and rejecting some of that. So then you have AI chatbots replacing some of the social media, and what is that going to mean? And you have elements of people who, the environment they're growing up in, the social media, the online environment, is causing unbelievable harm.
Congrats.
So it is, it's, yeah, I think it's complex.
Well, as somebody who does policy for a living, like, you're probably living through the most interesting time to go do it. And I'll put a link to your Substack in the notes for this, because you are genuinely one of the best people writing about this, especially in the Canadian context. So I appreciate you do that. And I know that we've sort of rambled all over the place, but like, there's been loads of little interesting threads that have been fascinating for me. God knows what it'll be like when I try and write this up.
Good luck.
But hopefully it was as interesting to you as it was to me.
No, definitely. It's been a fun chat. And yeah, so many threads like gone on for a long time.
Thank you once again for coming to all the way through an episode of the Challenger Cities podcast. When I started this, it was all about Toronto. We still had a pretty strong Canadian bent on this, what I'd call second season. We did 13 episodes in the first season. We've done 13 episodes in the second season. There's going to be a third season, don't worry. This isn't a goodbye. But I would love to get a bit of input from people of what kind of conversations would you like us to have? What's sort of standing out? Please do like and share and comment and whatnot. But really, really do invite the direction of what would people like as we've gone from a very Toronto-focused series when we started, now a slightly broader series. There's people that I'd love to talk to from like the Strong Towns movement. There's people we're going to bring in from various government organisations. There's some political leaders looking to get more involved in this. Hopefully we're going to bring in a few more diverse voices that don't just give us the usual city stories, but give us a few more like what have really interesting towns or smaller or lesser known places done that can be translated to cities. Anyway, I hope you're enjoying these. I'm really, really enjoying them. And we'll see you again very, very soon for what should be the start of series 3. So thank you very much.